her own subjectivity. Winnie Wong, founder of People for Bernie. Intersectionality, to me, on a very practical level, means that we are all equal, that there are no walls. We have to move forward and understand that liberation in one person means liberation of all people. When you wake up, and when you deal with someone on the street, you cannot think of them as being anyone else other than your neighbor, your brother, or your sister. Amanda Gorman, activist and youth poet laureate of the United States. Intersectionality is kind of a buzzword, and sometimes if you say a word too much, you forget its meaning. But intersectionality, for me, at least in the feminism movement, is a willingness to interrogate the ways in which our experiences converge and diverge, and also the commitment to unite for women's rights with that awareness. Young women of today have excavated something that is quite significant and builds upon the work of previous feminists. We're more open to interrogating the intersections of race, gender, class, ability, immigration, etc. And that type of critical thinking, which looks at a woman's identity as a mosaic rather than a one-color painting, I think that is the power behind women and girls of today. Carmen Perez, Women's March National Co-Chair. Intersectionality, for me, is my own existence as a woman of color. I am intersectional. I grew up in poverty. I also have a family member who's formerly incarcerated, a sister who passed away. As a woman of color, I see my intersectionality being my own existence, being able to navigate in multiple worlds, being able to understand that I'm not monolithic. As women, we're not monolithic. We can care about different things that impact us personally. Having a mother who was from Mexico and a father who was born in the U.S., again, that's being intersectional. It's understanding that we live in multiple worlds. Wendy Davis, former state senator and founder of Deeds Not Words. Here's how I think about intersectionality in terms of gender equality. If you go back to the early 1970s, women were demanding passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have created the backbone against which all of our fights for equality could have been supported. The fact that we weren't able to pass that created a different strategy. It was a strategy that decided we were going to take on issues separately and distinctly, bit by bit, so taking on equality of pay as a distinct issue, access to affordable contraception as a distinct issue, access to safe and legal abortion as a distinct issue, and so on. Each of those, of course, is an important piece of our overall goal of full equality. I think the same could be said when you look at the social justice movement. Whether we're talking about reforms that need to be made in the criminal justice arena, whether we're talking about making sure that we're providing legal protections against discrimination for people who are part of the LGBTQ community. Each of these pieces is an important part of an overall goal of equality, and we have to understand that they intersect, and that when we fight for one, we are fighting for a goal that benefits all. Where we can find ways to intersect and support each other, we're going to do a better job of advancing that big goal, and not just the separate little pieces and parts of it. Kayla Briette, filmmaker, composer, and musician. I was familiar with the term intersectionality, but what I didn't realize is that my whole life experience revolved around intersectionality. Like, whoa, that's the word to describe it. I grew up with a multicultural background. My mom is Chinese and Dutch Indonesian. My dad is full-blooded Native American. I grew up going to powwows and traditional dancing, Native American style. I also grew up folding dumplings and celebrating Chinese New Year. And there was this really confusing experience where I never knew exactly where I fit in, because I was a part of all these communities, but I never felt like I belonged to any specific community. In order to create my own story, I had to connect the dots between all of those different inspirations and infuse them into my own stories and rediscover that. That was my experience with intersectionality, connecting the dots between many different communities and finding your own ground amongst all of that. Gabrielle Gorman, filmmaker and Young Arts winner. I think intersectionality is understanding the parts of your identity that could be privileged and the parts of your identity that are not. As a black woman, I am oppressed in that way. I also have a citizenship to America, which is something that a lot of people do not have and a lot of people really want. That gives me a lot of privilege. I don't have to worry about people misgendering me, and therefore I don't have to worry about people discriminating against me because of that. In the feminist movement, you have to realize that women are oppressed in different ways depending on citizenship, race, sexuality, etc. Sarah McBride, National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, an LGBTQ activist. No one is walking through this world or navigating this world with only one identity. We're all walking through this world with, frankly, an infinite number of identities, some of which give us privilege, and some of which are marginalized. Intersectionality is an understanding of that multitude of identities in every person. For me, it's important to ingrain that in my work, because if in my advocacy on LGBTQ equality, I'm not also working on issues of racial justice, or immigrant rights, or gender equity, or combating xenophobia and Islamophobia, then I'm only going to create change for the most privileged in my own community. I'm only going to create change for those who maybe have one marginalized identity, but all of their other intersecting identities are identities of privilege. That's not the kind of change we need, and it's ignoring those who need it the most. So, I think being intersectional in your approach, it's not just necessary, it's the only way to go about change-making. Ai-Jen Poo, Director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and Co-Director of Caring Across Generations. Intersectionality, to me, is about power. It's about how we come together from the place where our stories meet, and how we build movements and campaigns, and how we essentially build power from the places where our interests intersect and come together. So if you're somebody who cares about the future of American families, I believe that that includes immigration reform and making sure that immigrant families can stay together, because they're so much a part of the fabric of American family life. It's about how we tell stories that knit people together and help people see their common interest and the way that their futures and their dreams are knitted together. Wazina Zandan, co-creator of Coming Out Muslim, Radical Acts of Love. To me, intersectionality means being willing to recognize that there are multiple ways and lenses through which one experience can be lived and received. Those lenses include race, geographic location, sexual orientation, faith, language, that kind of thing. And for me, intersectionality impacts me at the core of my work. It reflects the primary form or method through which I have to approach anything that I do. Initially, I came into this experience of intersectionality, at least the words of it, because I kept realizing that when I talked about gender or sexual orientation or whatever it was in college, and as a sex educator, my perspectives and the perspectives of the people who kind of looked like me or sounded like me were absent. And now intersectionality is also what I have to keep in mind when I do my work, because my students come in with a whole other range of ways that they are experiencing my classroom. Bob Bland, Women's March National Co-Chair. We can't be activists and organizers only to the areas of our self-interests. That's really the heart of intersectionality, to take an issue that does not directly affect you and see yourself in that. Lift this other human being, who you may know or you may not know, and know that there will be no justice for you, for your children, for your family, for your community, until there's justice for all people and all women. Jamia Wilson, Executive Director and Publisher of the Feminist Press at City University of New York. Intersectionality is really about understanding the pillars of oppression in the world that impact our lives based on the various identities that we hold. So when I think of systems of oppression that impact me, there's ableism, because I was born with a visual disability, anti-black racism because I'm African-American, and sexism because I am a cisgender woman. But I also have privileges that make it so that I get benefits that I was born into as well. So I was born into an upper-middle-class family. I was able to access elite education. I've always had health insurance, or it was somewhere within my grasp. And so those are the kinds of things, too, that when we show up with our identity, we're showing up with either the detriments that these systems have thrust upon us, or the advantages that have helped us get where we are that have nothing to do with our merits or our own individual talent. Tina Chen, former Chief of Staff to First Lady Michelle Obama and Executive Director of the Obama White House Council on Women and Girls. The issues that we have at hand, immigration reform, education reform, criminal justice reform, reproductive justice, each of those is impossible to understand in full without an intersectional lens. We have systems in place that historically and continuously create disadvantage for certain groups, and we can't fully appreciate the extent of that without looking at the cross-section of identity. In this work, intersectionality means a deepened layer when we talk about diversity and inclusion. It means more than just having more women or more people of color at the table or in government. It means having more women of color, more immigrant women with disabilities, more LGBTQ women from low-income areas, just to name a few. That's intersectionality. And when we don't take on that lens, someone will get left behind. Ashley Judd, actor, author, and activist. Ally is a verb as well as a noun. So I need to approach folks who are different from me with an open mind and say, I need your help. Please teach me about your experience. Being an ally requires a constant self-scrutiny for humility. Admitting my lapses is important. My Papaw Judd used to say, assuming makes an ASS out of you and me. Intersectionality means, to me, that so many factors are at play in creating the lived experience of every individual, including social, economic, educational, ethnic, and racial access to resources or lack thereof, and the type of political system in which one has been raised or is living. Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Network and Special Projects Director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Intersectionality looks at the ways in which race, class, gender, and other social positions impact our lived experiences. I see a lot of people talking about intersectionality these days, but they haven't taken the time to understand what it means and how it shows up in our lives. Intersectionality isn't diversity. It is fundamentally about relationships of power and how we embody those relationships and the impacts that power has on our lives and on the lives of others. I encourage everyone to actually read Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw's essay on intersectionality. We owe it to ourselves to get it right and not cut corners. Chapter 5. Your story matters. And other things that sound trite but are true. I'm an anxious person. When I first sought treatment for my very official generalized anxiety disorder, the clinical diagnosis I was given in 2010 after going to see my very first New York City therapist, I was hesitant to talk about it. Even though I wasn't ashamed of getting help, I live in New York. It feels like everyone's in therapy. There's still a certain taboo to admitting that you can't handle everything on your own. It's a weird and persistent double standard in our culture. Going to the doctor to deal with a physical ailment? Totally normal. Going to a medical professional to deal with your mind? Still less normal. And I was determined not to end up labeled the crazy girl. No one wants to be seen as crazy, and it's doubly bad to be the crazy girl. As months in therapy turned to years, I became more open about the whole process. I quickly found out I wasn't alone. I had to leave work early on Tuesdays to make my appointment, so I nervously told my boss. Her response? Of course, I'm in therapy too. Do what you need to do. I started talking about it more with my friends, old and new. I ended up inundated with requests for therapist referrals. I realized that other people related to my story and wanted to talk about the way mental health issues impacted their lives, too. And eventually, since I was working as a writer and editor at HuffPost, I decided to write about anxiety, including my own. This felt particularly scary. If you're a woman with a point of view on the internet, people are going to react strongly to you, often negatively so. And discussing something as personal as mental health brings an inevitable side of mocking, vitriol, armchair diagnosis, and dismissal. But when I published my first piece on women and anxiety, I was pleasantly surprised to discover that the response wasn't just Twitter trolls telling me that I'm a crazy bitch. In fact, many readers echoed relief that someone was articulating feelings that were deeply familiar. The messages poured in. Thank you so much for writing this. I forwarded your article to my boyfriend and said he had to read it if he wanted to understand me. I relate to this so hard. Sharing some of my personal struggles and experiences on a public platform, even in a small way, gave me a taste of how much our stories can impact the people we share them with. I'm probably not the first person to tell you, your story matters. If you hear it enough, it begins to sound both painfully obvious and almost meaningless. If you're a millennial or a Gen Zer, you know all about storytelling. We do it regularly on social media. But as I began speaking with women for this book, the theme came up over and over and over again. Your story matters. The way we think about our lives, our families, our nation, and our future relies on storytelling. We need to tell ourselves a story about our purpose and place in history and ascribe meaning to what we get up and do each day. If stories can guide our daily lives and tell us what it means to be an American, changing those things requires new and varied stories. And right now, though the landscape is changing, the stories that we hear most often and most loudly are still by and for and about white, cisgender, straight, able-bodied men. If you fall outside of these labels, or within them but challenge the dominant narrative attached to those labels, telling your story and your truth can be a radical act. It's our responsibility to share our stories, 19-year-old filmmaker Caleb Riatt told me, because when we don't have our stories told, we become denied identity. And once we're denied identity, we become invisible. All of us human beings, we're all storytellers. When you share your story, you tell the world that you deserve to be seen and heard. And when you share your story with someone who isn't exactly like you, you give them the gift of expanding their own world. Ultimately, storytelling is a way to both create connections and assert the right to take up space within your own community and with people outside of that community. And that's exactly what Wazina Zondon and Turna Tilighiado's storytelling performance, Coming Out Muslim, Radical Acts of Love, seeks to do in exploring the intersection of Muslim identity and queer identity. Coming Out Muslim was first developed as an 8-week training for youth workers focused on disrupting Islamophobia ahead of the 10-year anniversary of 9/11. Zondon and Tilighiado both identify as queer and Muslim, so it felt natural and important to them to include queer Muslim experiences and narratives within the training. Eventually, they were approached by one of the training participants, a theater major. She asked if they would be interested in continuing the conversation about queer Muslim experiences by developing a show. Zondon and Tilighiado said yes. Thus, Coming Out Muslim was born. For both Turna and myself, we felt very invisible most of the time, Zondon told me. We recognized the need and necessity to reclaim the narrative about who we are, as immigrants, as women, as Muslims, as women of color. And I think for young women, first-generation women, women of color, or queer girls, many of us don't have role models or pathmakers before us. And so this was an opportunity for us to make paths for the girls that will come after us. Zondon compares storytelling to lobbying in its power to affect social change. Lobbying really at its source is telling the story that will get lawmakers to change their perspective, she explained. And when you tell stories and you share your experiences and you hear other people's stories, you get to connect on the level of the heart. There's some scientific evidence to back up the theory that exposure to someone's story, especially when it happens in an intimate setting among people who already know or identify with one another, can make an impact. A 2006 review of 515 relevant studies found that intergroup contact typically reduces intergroup prejudice. In other words, that means that spending time around someone who is a member of a marginalized group that you are not a part of can decrease your biases and misconceptions about that group. Of course, turning these heartening findings and anecdotal successes into a larger movement is not without its challenges. After all, a friend or family member opening up to another friend about her sexuality or her abortion or the racial discrimination she's experienced is likely to be far more effective when it comes to changing hearts and minds than a stranger watching another stranger's story on YouTube. Look no further than the comments under any YouTube video for proof of that. Over the last 5 years, the abortion rights movement has particularly embraced storytelling as a tool for reducing stigma. The One in Three campaign, which harnesses women's abortion stories to begin to build a culture of compassion, empathy, and support for access to basic health care, and the Shout Your Abortion movement, which started as a hashtag in 2015, are predicated on the idea that our stories contain untapped power. Although the jury is still out on how effective these campaigns are, it's worth remembering that social change takes time, and lots of it. And if each of our stories impacts just one person in a profound way, it's worth telling them. As Raquel Willis put it, the whole idea of being empowered comes from information. And I think that information comes from stories. There's so much that we learn when we open our ears and are empathetic to other people's narratives. Sarah McBride understands intimately what a crucial role storytelling can play in advocacy. The 27-year-old LGBTQ activist boasts an insanely impressive resume. Not only is she the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, but in 2016, she also became the first transgender American to address a major party convention when she spoke at the Democratic National Convention. During that speech, Sarah didn't simply speak about trans rights in generalities. She spoke about coming out while serving as student body president at American University. And she spoke about her late husband and fellow LGBTQ activist, Andy Cray. Sarah and Andy met in June 2012 at a White House reception honoring the LGBTQ community. In 2013, Andy discovered that he had cancer. And in 2014, after a period of remission, that cancer came back. This time it was terminal. Sarah became a caregiver, and then she became a wife. She also became an even fiercer advocate for social change. It's this experience that she spoke about at the DNC. I met Andy, who was a transgender man, fighting for equality, and we fell in love, she told the thousands in the audience and the many more watching from home. And yet, even in the face of his terminal illness, this 28-year-old, he never wavered in his commitment to our cause and his belief that this country can change. We married in 2014, and just 4 days after our wedding, he passed away. Sarah used her own story to connect on a human level with those listening to her, and used that human connection to draw attention not only to her personal experience, but to all of the far-reaching intersectional work that still needs to be done when it comes to trans rights. And as she later explained to me, she believes that her ability to be a storyteller is what ultimately allowed her to advocate for the trans community at a national party convention. Advocacy can't just be spouting off statistics. Advocacy has to come from the heart, and in many cases, that includes storytelling, Sarah told me. I had a story that I was willing to share that underscored the fact that transgender people are people. That transgender people love and hope and dream and fear and cry and laugh just like everyone else. It was important to all of us that with that platform, that short time on stage, we conveyed that simple fact to people who were watching. Because at the end of the day, there's the cliche, people don't remember what you say, they remember how you make them feel. And I was willing to share my personal story and stand on that stage and be, for lack of a better term, vulnerable in front of a lot of people. It's a lesson that I've learned over the course of my advocacy. Sometimes the best path to power and equality is through public vulnerability and allowing people to see us in our full humanity. That's a lesson that can be hard to take to heart, especially for women who are socialized to believe that we should never put ourselves at the center. We think we might take up too much space, be too much. And while sometimes it's important to step aside, it's also on us to fight against these instincts to an extent that we don't end up invisible and unheard. We need to tell our own stories, and use whatever privilege we have to amplify the stories of others. We need to assert that we matter. You matter. Senator Elizabeth Warren said it best when I asked her why we needed young women's voices in the fight for social justice. Young women have valuable experiences and perspectives, she said. They will enrich the political discussion and help us reach more inclusive decisions. I look at it this way. If you don't have a seat at the table, then you're probably on the menu. Part 2. How to Resist Like a Girl. Chapter 6. How to Stop Watching Netflix, Get Off Your Couch, and Get Shit Done Now. We have to do something. This sentence played through my head thousands of times on November 9th, 2016. I had been dragged into the HuffPost office that morning by my work wife, Jess, on about 3.5 hours of restless sleep. The night before, my team and I had left the Javits Center, the glass-ceilinged building where Hillary Clinton's election night watch party was taking place, after one of us broke out in hives, one of us broke out in a heat rash, and one of us, read me, found herself on her knees outside trying to stave off a panic attack as one of her favorite actresses chain-smoked mere feet away. We ended up around the corner from Javits and spent the remainder of the night into the early morning hours speaking to the men and women who were leaving Clinton's public block party. They streamed out in groups, clutching one another and the American flags that had been given out during a more hopeful hour, some rolled up tightly and some gripped in fists. We were all just trying to hold on. I gave up on even that base-level goal around 1:30 a.m. My credit card refused to work as I tried to pay for my taxi ride back to Brooklyn. I was exhausted after a long, unexpected night's work. My heart hurt. I was grief-stricken. And in that moment, it felt like someone had died. More than that, it felt like my country, or at least the tenuous, idealized vision I had of it, had died. As I swiped my card for the fifth and then sixth time, I broke. I burst into ragged sobs, to the point where the poor driver had to pull over and help me work the credit card machine. "I'm scared, too," he told me as he helped me out of the taxi and onto the curb outside my apartment. The next day felt like a blur, partly because I had eventually taken a sleeping pill to force myself to get a bit of shut-eye, and partly because it seemed like everyone I knew, regardless of political worldview, was trying to figure out what came next. We would not have our first woman president. We would instead have a president who had campaigned on an openly anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-woman platform. I wrote like a motherfucker, as Cheryl Strayed would say, that day, because work has always helped me process my most ragged emotions. By the afternoon, I was gripped by an overwhelming need to do more. In dire need of the wonderful women in my life, feeling thankful they exist, I emailed my friend Lindsay. She responded quickly with a post-work plan. "Let's go somewhere dark, quiet, and where it's always 4 a.m. And so we did just that, recruiting Jess and our friend Julie to come along. Out of that night of brainstorming came a mission. We were going to create a space for empowerment and action on a day when many Americans would need it, Inauguration Day. While I was desperately trying not to throw up and trying to write a story in a giant fluorescent-lit room at the Javits Center, 33-year-old Haley Stevens was upstairs trying to maintain a sense of what she termed optimistic denial. Haley, who worked for Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign and subsequently took a post in the Obama administration, flew into New York City from southeastern Michigan to attend what she assumed would be Clinton's victory party with one of her best friends from college. Instead, she wound up in a crowded room trying to be upbeat while she fielded texts from friends and family all over the country and watched Clinton supporters and staffers burst into tears. She stayed at the Javits Center until the wee hours when Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, finally came out and announced that Clinton would not be addressing her supporters that night. As someone who had volunteered extensively for the campaign and knew many of Clinton's staffers, Haley ended up going out with them until 6 in the morning, cracking jokes and trying to keep everyone's energy up. And she found herself saying out loud that she might run for office. At the election night party, I was hyped because I was really furious, she told me. I remember saying, I think I might run for something. I might run. I just was like, the only way I can respond to this is by stepping up. So she stepped up. Haley began fundraising for a congressional run in Michigan's 11th district, located just northwest of Detroit, encompassing parts of Wayne and Oakland counties. She hopes to channel her anger and energy into making a difference in her home state, a place she knows and cares about deeply. And Haley is far from alone. Hillary Clinton's loss and the rise of Donald Trump, a political figure so diametrically opposed to Clinton and women's rights as a whole, motivated thousands of women to consider elected office. Within a month after the election, She Should Run, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to expanding the talent pool of future elected female leaders, heard from more than 4,500 women across the political spectrum. By mid-February, that number had risen to nearly 13,000. She Should Run founder and CEO Erin Lowes Cotraro summed up what she was seeing in the months following Trump's election and inauguration. There's an air of activism right now, and it's having a snowball effect. Rachel Thomas, former communications director at Emily's List, a political action committee, PAC, that works to elect pro-choice Democratic women across the nation, called the drive of women to run for office since President Trump took office unprecedented. By mid-April 2017, Emily's List had heard from more than 11,000 women. In the previous 22 months, they'd heard from 900. Women run for office because they want to fix something or they're mad as hell about something, said Rachel. And the presidential election brought out women who might feel one way, or might feel both ways, about what they're seeing in Washington and their state legislatures across the country. Being mad as hell can be a great tool for motivating yourself to do that fixing. And that's because anger, righteous, energizing, directed anger, is a powerful force. But of course, it can't end at anger. That anger needs to translate into action. My post-election anger, coupled with the post-election anger of a handful of other women, turned into a summit on January 21, 2017. Through our event, Watch Us Run, my friends, who also happen to be my colleagues, and I turned manic energy and fear into something light and tangible. Of course, before Watch Us Run could be an actual thing, we had to do a hell of a lot of work. My co-organizers and I were lucky enough to work for name-brand media companies, which meant we had platforms and a decent base of contacts, but none of us had ever planned a summit from the ground up. The biggest event I had planned prior to this one was probably a staff trip for my summer camp, so I basically had no clue what I was doing. Our goals were simple. Attract interesting speakers from either side of the political aisle, figure out a venue in a location that would make sense for an event being held on Inauguration Day, promote the event to attract enough people to attend, and somehow fund the whole thing. Okay, so not actually simple at all. My friends and I started by going back to our bosses and their bosses and asking if HuffPost and Bustle would be willing to put their names behind our event. We brought in more of our colleagues, women in leadership positions at both brands, across editorial, communications, and marketing, and we decided we would be scrappy and that we weren't above begging for money to get this thing off the ground. A consultant for Bustle happened to be a member of the National Press Club, and by some small miracle, they still had rooms available for rent on Inauguration Day. The space was affordable and downtown in Washington, D.C., so we jumped at the chance to secure it, assuming we'd figure out the rest as we went. And somehow we did. We sent emails to every high-profile, politically engaged woman we had contact information for. We crafted pitches for marketing purposes. We reached out to feminist brands that might be interested in donating merchandise for the gift bags we gave our speakers, all of whom agreed to participate for free. We planned a run of the show centered on the themes of grassroots activism, art as resistance, and running for elected office. HuffPost's parent company, AOL, was kind enough to assign someone on the events team to help us figure out logistics with the venue. Her name is Sarah, and we referred to her as Literal Angel for that whole month. She performed miracles, such as getting costs shaved down so that we didn't blow through our meager budget and saving us from having the event in a room with very little airflow and far too much backlighting. It all began to feel very real when Jess, HuffPost's then director of communications, Lena, and I wound up on a phone call with Ashley Judd, actress and activist extraordinaire. Despite being under the weather, Ashley was interested in being a keynote speaker at our summit. And unlike many celebrities who only communicate through their publicists, she wanted to be on the phone with us to really talk through her involvement. After we hung up the phone, the three of us did a silent happy dance in a huddle room. Maybe this thing would actually make some sort of small impact after all. The day before Donald Trump was sworn in as President of the United States, five of us spent hours doing a walkthrough of the event space for Watch Us Run, reviewing logistics and stuffing gift bags in a tiny hallway. It was tedious work, but it was also invigorating. We were creating something. In the place where they would be holding the hashtag MAGA Deplorable that night, no less. And we were working rather than wallowing. It felt damn good. On Inauguration Day, 400 men and women packed into the National Press Club in D.C. We had panels on how to run for office, the role of art in resistance, and grassroots activism. Michael Moore led us in a group primal scream, and Ashley Judd and Representative Barbara Lee led affirmations. We streamed all of it on Facebook Live, and 1.5 million people across the country tuned in. "I will feel all my feelings," said Ashley Judd, wearing a pink pussy hat, as the audience repeated her words back to her. After the day wrapped up, a man I had never met approached me. Lindsay and I had been emceeing the event, so we had hardly paused to speak to anyone. "Thank you," he told me earnestly as he gave me a warm hug. "You saved my day." Our small summit wouldn't change the world or the country, but it did change a few people's days, and that was a start. Like me and like Haley, so many women across the country and the world felt compelled in the wake of a confusing and divisive election to do more. And if you're listening to this book, you probably want to do more too. Simple ways to join the resistance today or tomorrow, because sometimes today is really freaking exhausting. 1. Call, fax, email, and confront your reps. Set an alarm on your phone, find a buddy to hold you accountable, and just do it. Be reasonable about the commitment. Can you find 10 minutes every day? Every other day? Make a plan and stick to it. When your senator or congressperson has a town hall, show up. If they haven't scheduled a town hall, ask them to. When people express their concerns in large numbers, our elected representatives have to listen. 2. Run for office, and/or encourage the women in your life to. Okay, so this one isn't exactly simple, and you don't have to do it right away, but it's deeply important. The more women who run for office, the more women who win. And the more women who win, the more seats at the table we have. If you're interested in exploring a run for office at some point in the future, get in touch with organizations such as She Should Run, Emily's List, Run for Something, Ignite, Sister District, and Emerge. And if there's a woman you know who you think would make a great candidate, nominate her through She Should Run's Ask a Woman to Run for Office program. 3. Donate what you can. There are already organizations out there that are dedicated to nearly any cause you can think of, and the number one thing most of them need right now? Money. It may sound unglamorous or lazy, but truly, these groups, most of whom have been doing this work for years, need to pay their employees, purchase materials, and keep their doors open. Your donations, no matter how small, can make a difference. We'll talk more about this in the next chapter. 4. Volunteer your time. As Mother of the Movement Lucy McBath told me, start volunteering your time and your effort. That's how you grow into an activist or a movement. That's all it simply is that being mad enough and angry enough about something to make a difference. 5. Start having tough conversations with people you might disagree with, offline. Absolutely don't get on Twitter and start spamming your trolls with links to op-eds about healthcare and immigration, or tweets that cleverly tell them to fuck off. Not only is that unfulfilling, except maybe in the moment, but it's a waste of time and emotional energy. What you absolutely should do is start wading into loving, empathetic chats with friends and family members who come at a given issue from a different vantage point than you do. Resist like a girl. One of the negative effects of social media is that we don't have the deep, recurring conversations that we need to have to move people forward in their awareness and in their empathy and in their shared humanity, Women's March National Co-Chair Bob Bland told me. Twitter is the most political social media platform, and it's also the most cutthroat platform, because it allows you the shortest amount of time to make a statement. And so in 140 characters, you're going to condense whatever it is you're trying to express into the most potent statement you can. That can be beautiful if it's love, but all too often it's hate or fear or cynicism. She also pointed out the obvious, that people speak to one another very differently on Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat than they do in real life. To encourage people to talk face-to-face with people they already know, the Women's March organizers launched an initiative called Daring Discussions, along with a toolkit to help you start such conversations, which can be found at daringdiscussions.com. The toolkit includes guidelines. Ground yourself in love. Be aware of the privilege you hold. Be unconditionally accepting. As well as sample questions. What motivated you to participate in this discussion? What are you most hopeful about when you think about the future? What do you want to know, but have been afraid to ask about the other side of this topic? These empathetic conversations only work when both people involved are open to having them. Don't go in looking to definitively change anyone's mind. Go in looking for understanding. You may end up finding common ground you never knew existed. 6. Listen to the women who are already leading the resistance, especially women of color. There's an instinct among a lot of young women to want to start something when they experience a political awakening. And it's understandable. You want to be as involved as possible. You want to feel ownership over this energy and the impact you'd like to make. But there are veterans in the trenches who have been fighting this fight for years. Seek them out and follow them because they will know where your energy would be best applied. Toward the end of November, I accompanied my friend Liz to an organizing meeting at an acquaintance's Brooklyn townhouse. There were activists of all different areas of expertise and backgrounds in attendance. But something that really struck me was when a young black woman stood up and addressed her white sisters in the room. She asked us to put ourselves on the front lines of resistance so that women of color didn't always have to be there, standing alone. 7. Show up, show up, show up. Even when it's not directly about you. Your body is your greatest tool and weapon. Deploy it wisely, to physically be there for the people and causes you care about. If you're a white woman, this is doubly important. Women of color are consistently on the front lines of the fight for social justice, and their bodies are at risk in a way that white women's bodies are, more often, not. We all tend to get the most fired up when our personal rights are impacted. After all, empathy takes work. But the fight for human rights is ultimately one fight. If we leave people to fend only for themselves, we will all ultimately fail. Chapter 7. A Tech-Savvy Guide to Staying Accountable. So, you're angry, you're motivated, and you want to make a difference. But what comes next? It's easy to feel as though you're getting swept up in a Twitter, Facebook news spiral that leaves you with a whole lot of anxiety and very little idea of what to do about it. Luckily, we have it much easier than the women who came before us, because many of us are walking around with tiny computers in our hands at all times. Thanks to smartphones, data, and readily accessible Wi-Fi, it's easier than ever to access our elected representatives basically anytime, anywhere. To get you started, here are some apps, websites, and guides that can help direct your activism, keep you on track, and make sure you're using the time you have to dedicate to the cause wisely. You can fax your senator via text, donate funds to fight for women's rights and criminal justice reform with a few taps, and get a GIF of Beyoncé delivered into your inbox along with a call to action. What a time to be alive. If you want to text your reps, use ResistBot. What it is, a bot that lets you send official-looking faxes to your senators and congresspersons all through text message. How it works. To get started, text RESIST to 50409. The bot will prompt you to give your name and address in order to locate your representatives. Once you've done that, you just type the message you want to send to your reps and text that to the bot. ResistBot does the rest of the work for you, putting together an official-looking fax, complete with your address, your representative's D.C. office address, the date, and a signature. You even get a follow-up text confirming that the fax has been received. Why it's great. You're not reading off a script or copy-pasting someone else's talking points. You can really personalize your messages. But because it's over text, it just feels easier than sitting down and crafting an email. And if something pisses you off while you're out with friends or doing work or trying to come up with that truly perfect 140-character zinger, within 5 minutes, you can let your senator know exactly how you feel. If you want your action to come with a side of comprehensive information, use Countable. What it is, an app, available on desktop, for Android, and for iPhone, that keeps you up to date on political news and upcoming local and national legislation, and lets you contact your representatives directly from articles. How it works. Countable has several moving parts. The core of the app is a running list of bills that will be voted on in Congress. When users tap into a bill, Countable provides a summary and details of the legislation, a yay argument, a nay argument, an explanation of how far the legislation has progressed, and the ability to vote on said legislation. These yay or nay votes are then tallied and sent along to your representatives. The app also has a news feed that gives neutral updates on and explanations of political news. Users can comment on specific bills or news within the app and have the option to call or message their reps directly from articles. Why it's great. Countable has it all. Unbiased explanations of legislation, easy ways to take action and share information, and a simple way to keep up with all the things your representatives are voting on. You can even register to vote through Countable and get email alerts when your reps cast votes. If you want to turn the country blue, use Swing Left. What it is, a mailing list that sends its members curated calls to action based on the swing district closest to where they live. Swing Left's goal is to help Democrats take back a majority in the House. How it works. You go to swingleft.org and type in your address or zip code. Swing Left then determines where the closest swing district, that is, a district that Democrats may have a chance of winning or won narrowly in the previous election, is. You can then sign up to join the team helping in that district. Once you do that, Swing Left will send you emails, but not so frequently that they will overwhelm your inbox, with ways to get involved, fundraising, knocking on doors for a specific candidate, registering voters, phone banking, events, and more. Why it's great. If you are someone who wants to be involved in progressive electoral politics, but lives in a solidly blue district, Swing Left gives you tangible ways to help. If you want to put your money where your mouth is, use Super Good. What it is, a platform that lets you make daily donations to organizations that support the causes you care about. How it works. You can create a profile on super-good.org through your Gmail, Facebook, or Twitter account. Once you've signed up, you can choose causes to support and choose an amount of money to donate per day. Your daily donation is multiplied by 30, and that amount is charged to your credit card on a monthly basis. Super Good then handles splitting up your donations among the causes you've selected and donating the total funds to each organization they support on a monthly basis. Super Good focuses on 10 major causes: free press, education, environment, civil liberties, women's rights, anti-hate, criminal justice reform, immigration, indigenous rights, and LGBTQ rights. The funds that Supergood collects for each cause are distributed among three different organizations per cause. For example, Planned Parenthood, Black Lives Matter, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Earth Justice. According to Supergood's website, the causes and organizations will evolve over time. Why it's great. It can be super overwhelming to feel like you can't afford to donate to all of the causes that matter. Through Supergood, you don't have to choose between fighting police brutality and fighting climate change, and you don't have to set up 15 different recurring donations. And since you can donate as little as 50 cents per day, it all feels financially manageable. If you want something to do every day, use Daily Action. What it is: a text bot that sends you a call to action each weekday and connects you directly to your representatives. How it works: to get started, you text DAILY to 228466. You will then be prompted for your zip code. Once that's all done, Daily Action will text you each morning with something to do. Past calls to action have focused on things like calling members of Congress to demand that stronger economic sanctions be imposed against Russia, joining the Women's March, and urging representatives to oppose the Trump administration's health care bill. The bot also connects you directly to your reps with a quick swipe. Why it's great: calling your representatives is considered one of the most effective ways to get their attention. After all, often a staffer has to physically pick up the phone. Daily Action makes that call easy and routine. During the first week of Donald Trump's presidency alone, more than 10,000 people made calls to Congress through Daily Action. If you're phone shy, use 5Calls. What it is: an app, which is also available as a website, that guides you through 5 calls to your representatives each day, depending on what's important to you. How it works: download the app or go to 5calls.org and type in your location. You will be asked what's important to you that day from a list of 10 options. These choices change depending on where you live, what legislation is upcoming, and what's going on in the news. Once you choose, 5Calls will direct you to a summary of an issue and provide you with a fill-in-the-blank script to guide calls to your representatives. You can call your congressperson and senators right from the app, and after you call, the app lets you log the outcome. Did you make contact? Leave a voicemail? Was your rep unavailable? No matter what, log it and move on to call number 2. Why it's great: sometimes it's just too exhausting or nerve-wracking to figure out what to say once you get someone from your representative's office on the phone. Phone calls can be super awkward. And while it's ideal to personalize every call you make, having a script can be a huge relief. If you need motivation to keep fighting, use Signal Boost. What it is: a kick-ass intersectional feminist online newsletter and a weekly SiriusXM show dedicated to boosting the hell out of the great work being done in the resistance, founded by former Hillary Clinton campaign staffers Zerlina Maxwell and Jess McIntosh. How it works: sign up and wait for the emails to arrive. Each one contains an update on a few key issues and suggestions for concrete ways to act on those issues. Think of it like the skim for the resistance. An archive of Signal Boost blasts can be found at signal-boost.com. Why it's great: it's concise, women-led, and fun to read. Some weeks are harder than others, and when you get exhausted and feel like giving up, Zerlina and Jess are there to remind you to keep going. Plus, the GIFs are excellent and often feature Beyoncé. Hashtag do it for the GIFs. If you want to play the long game, use Indivisible. What it is: a comprehensive guide to resisting the Trump agenda using local actions, as laid out by former congressional staffers. How it works: the guide grew out of a simple post-election question. For progressive America, what comes next? Two congressional staffers looked at the basic tactics that the Tea Party had used during the Obama years and used them as a framework to create a guide, originally put online in a Google Doc for progressives who wanted to know how to resist. The guide also included information on how members of Congress think, the best ways to get under their skin and command their attention. Since then, Indivisible has grown into much more than a guide. Indivisible groups have popped up all over the nation, and the Indivisible website lets you find resources, locate local groups to join, and register your own group in the Indivisible network. Why it's great. Indivisible isn't just a guide. It's a movement. If you don't have easy access to a computer or smartphone, use the local public library or your school's computer lab if you're in school. What it is. You already know this one. How it works. Log on to a computer and go to www.usa.gov/elected-officials. This website will allow you to look up the senators, congressperson, and local elected officials who represent you, then figure out who it makes the most sense to contact. Are you worried about a bill that the House is considering? Call or email your representative. Do you want to make sure your city remains a sanctuary city or upholds the Paris Climate Accord? Call or email your mayor. Elected officials have their office's phone number and email address on their individual websites, and if you go to http://www.house.gov/representatives or http://www.senate.gov/senators/contact, you can find all the contact information for members of Congress in one place. Why it's great? Because anyone can do it. And just so you have it offline, here is a very basic script to help you guide your calls and emails. Calling your rep? Hi, I'm a your state district voter, and I'm calling to urge name of elected official to whatever you want them to do. As a young person, woman, person of color, other identity, this is deeply important to me and other voters like me. Add any related personal story if you have one. Thank you for your time. Emailing your rep? Hi, name of elected official. My name is your name, and I'm a voter in your state district. I'm writing to express your feeling about X issue. Include any personal experience you've had with the issue here. Thank you for taking the time to consider this, and I urge you to suggested action. Best, your name. Chapter 8. Lady Clubs and Covens, where the real work and magic happens. 3 days after the 2016 presidential election, a new friend slid into my Twitter DMs to invite me to a feminist consciousness-raising meeting. Hey, lady, she wrote. I'm not sure if someone forwarded you the message, but I'm having people over for a consciousness-raising meeting to discuss feelings and practical actions that we can take to, you know, try to stop the human rights apocalypse. I immediately accepted her invitation. You might be asking, Emma, what the heck is a consciousness-raising meeting, and why does it sound like something out of the 1960s and 70s? If the term sounds a bit retro, that's because it is. Consciousness-raising is an activist strategy popularized in the late 60s by radical leaders within the women's movement. The idea is pretty simple. Come together, in person, to share life experiences with other women in order to understand what it actually means to be oppressed on a practical level. Saying sexism exists is one thing. Hearing 5 or 10 or 15 women discuss the overlapping ways that sexism plays out for them is quite another. Conclusions drawn in these groups can then be used to draft papers or spark actions. Radical feminist Carol Hanisch, best known for popularizing the statement, "The personal is political," wrote about the beginnings of consciousness raising within the women's movement for the feminist magazine On the Issues in 2010. According to Hanisch, during a 1968 New York Radical Women meeting, Anne Forer, another member of the group, said that women needed to raise our consciousness in order to properly consider themselves an oppressed group. As Hanisch wrote of that meeting, Anne went on to list a number of things women had to do to make themselves attractive to men, like not wearing our glasses, playing dumb, doing all kinds of painful things to our bodies, wearing uncomfortable clothing and shoes, going on diets, all because people don't find the real self of a woman attractive. This naming of specific and personal forms of oppression, regardless of how seemingly small, was picked up by other members of the group, specifically Kathy Sarachild, who took the phrase and tactic and ran with it. Later that year, Sarachild presented a program for feminist consciousness raising.